Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guests tonight are Christoph Irmscher. He directs the Wells Scholars Program at Indiana University Bloomington, where he's also Distinguished Professor of English. And Richard J. King, Visiting Associate Professor of Maritime Literature and History at the Sea Education Association in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. And we're talking about their fascinating new book, Audubon at Sea, The Coastal and Transatlantic Adventures of John James Audubon. Christoph, Richard, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to be talking to you about this book.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks, Mark.
Now, this is a book. This is really interesting. I think a lot of people, when they hear the name Audubon, they envision like the long-haired Audubon with the long gun tromping through the swamps and forests, shooting, you know, warblers or other things. This book paints a totally different picture of an Audubon that most people never even think about. Whose idea was it to come up with this, a pelagic Audubon?
That was Rich's idea, so he should respond to that question.
So, Richard, why did you come up with this? Because it is a totally different perspective on how we think about Audubon.
Sure, yeah. This book is really a product of about 8 or 9 years of work between the two of us. And it started with, I was working on a series of American literature of the sea and trying to expand the different voices and perspectives about the ocean. And so I had read some of the work of Audubon and these sort of amazing essays about the Florida Keys and the Gulf of St. Lawrence. And then I had met Christoph when I was doing work with cormorants, and then I read his book about Louis Agassiz and contacted him because he really is sort of the leading Audubon scholar, or one of them, in the country. And so I was able to recruit him, and then we sort of got going, and it's been really a long period of time of really digging into these stories and essays and trying to put Audubon in a, like you said, a pelagic perspective.
What's interesting about what you've done in this book is you've compiled and edited Audubon's own writings. So we're not reading your writings, although you write fascinating introductions to all the different sections. And I want to say you also have great footnotes, which I really, really liked. But the effect on the reader is just really interesting. You never think about Audubon on the ocean. First of all, he got seasick, didn't he?
Oh yes, he was. He suffered from seasickness, which was not unusual. Darwin was sick part of the time, at least on the Beagle. So, just for context, he was essentially a landlubber, and he never was able to shed that seasickness as he traveled. Which seems weird because Audubon was born in Haiti, really, he essentially grew up on the transatlantic passage, and he went back and forth multiple times. In fact, there's a map in our book that tracks his various voyages. But he was never able to get over that. So there was always sort of a feeling of kind of queasiness associated with that. At the same time, it also increased his respect for these birds, because birds to him were always, in a way, superior to human beings. Because they can cross borders, they fly, they can do all sorts of things that humans can't. But the water adds something else to it. These birds, most of them at least, don't only fly, they can also manage the water. They can sit on the water. They are in this element that to Audubon always represents something that he cannot aspire to.
What's fascinating, though, is his use of nature. He sought to preserve birds for eternity in his art. This is from your book. But as a naturalist, he hunted them, killed them by the barrelful, and often ate them. And what comes out very clearly in this book is Audubon's really sort of wanton use of nature for his artwork. I mean, he shot and destroyed a tremendous amount of birds of a single species.
Yes, yes, he did. Some of it, of course, is due to the fact that, you know, when you use a shotgun of the type, a rifle of the type Audubon used, if you shoot that into a flock of birds, there's a lot of collateral damage, really. So that's something that has to be kept in mind. And also in order, especially with the smaller birds, in order to obtain usable species, he definitely had to collect several specimens because many of them would be so destroyed that that they were useless for his art, essentially. So that was one that's one aspect of the problem. For context, though, one also has to remember that for Audubon, that Audubon was even in the context of his time, sometimes a little extreme. His immediate predecessor, Alexander Wilson, for instance, was not known for slaughter on the same
scale. No, not at all.
He actually believed in painting from life, because he felt that if you kill, you get distorted images of birds. So that's worth keeping in mind, too.
It's fascinating because Audubon would come across other people who were slaughtering birds at a much higher rate than he was, and he would bemoan the fact that nature herself is perishing, but at the same time he was contributing to it.
Yes, and you see something you're referring to the episodes they wrote in Labrador where he was watching people.
Oh my God! Yeah,
with oars essentially wantonly killing birds, now knocking them down with in the most brutal manner possible. And one of the things that you see in Audubon is also the kind of selfishness of the artist coming out, because he's horrified as a human being by what he witnesses. But at the end of one of these episodes, he said, they are not leaving any specimens for
me.
That's the problem. If you go like that as a reader, you go like, come on. You know, there's something extremely appealing about Audubon, something that's so rewarding when you study him, but he's also monstrous to some degree.
And that's what makes him fascinating.
Yes.
Now, the contents of this book are fascinating. The big, fat sort of central section are sections taken from his ornithological biography. Can somebody talk to me about what that was? A lot of people aren't familiar with the fact that he wrote as well as painted birds. Somebody? Ornithological biography?
Yeah. Rich was responsible for the selections. I would just generally say that for me, when I started working on Audubon 3 decades ago, it was a revelation for me to see that he produced 3,000 pages of text,
I know.
Bird descriptions. And they were not just these kinds of ineffective sort of ramblings in the natural history tradition of this is what I happen to see, but they follow a very, very precise structure, and they were impactful. A lot of people don't know this, but the bird biographies, the ornithological biography, as Audubon wanted it to be known, is one of the most frequently cited sources in Darwin's The Descent of Man. For Darwin, they were a gold mine when it came to observations about bird behavior. And Rich maybe can talk a little bit about his criteria for selection, because Rich went ahead and he read all those thousands of pages and made a selection for our volume from that.
Rich, I really appreciated your selection of birds too. One of the things that your selection emphasizes, he was a wonderful observation of bird behavior.
Yeah, and I could add that I had some research assistants also that helped out. So we compiled this all together and back and forth with Christoph and others. But I think what is really interesting is that these essays really represent some rare marine environmental history of sort of what did the coastline look like in the 1820s and 1830s. And so he's not just talking about bird behavior, although he gives these amazing details of sort of abundance of nests and areas of nests and migration periods and nesting periods.
Well, but yeah, for species like black skimmers, like he would describe wonderfully how they fly. And I thought those kinds of descriptions were really fascinating to read.
Yeah, and that, you know, that's been one of the sort of joys of the anthology, was bringing some of these biographies to modern-day ornithologists and asking them, hey, you know, is this environmental history useful, and what can we learn from this? You know, what did Audubon get correct? What periods did he give? And so, for example, one of the most beautiful passages and paintings is the one of the northern gannet up in up in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, and modern-day ornithologists have told us that they still use that account both for sort of abundance, nesting period, even erosion of the islands, so they can get a sense of what the area looked like 150 years ago.
I was fascinated by his descriptions of American oyster catchers nesting, because he described that there was different nesting habits in the northern and the southern birds. And that's one of the – I've only seen them nesting around here in Massachusetts and further south. But he was saying that they nest on rocks up north. Is that true? I didn't – you know, that's one of those things I don't even know.
You know, that's a good question. I want to say that it is true, but, yeah, we'd have to check it. Yeah.
So, but he had all these details like that, which were just absolutely incredible. And then oftentimes he would take birds and they would be on board ship. Like he had certain alcids running around on ship and he would describe about how they would try to take off. I was fascinated when he talked about the long-billed curlew, about how common they were, and they're not anymore. I mean, they're still around, but they're just not anymore common.
Yes, and one of the things, too, which refer to the northern gamut, it's not just factual writing. It's writing in which he, as the observer, is emotionally engaged. Mm. So when he's describing the flight of the northern gamut, he's admiring it, and he says it's the most wonderful thing you've ever seen. The gamut is powerful, elegant, and so forth, and he follows it, and then he finds himself wishing that he could fly just like that. But then he reminds himself that these gannets will fly 80, 90 miles with no problem. And as he's following the bird, the gannet lands on the water and swallows a fish whole. And then there's, of course, the distance again between the observer and the bird, and he's reminded that this is a bird, and then very, very different kind of different life form for me. So it's always this kind of play between intimacy and distance, really, that he's after. On the one hand, they are just like me, and I can understand them, and I have privileged access to them. But at the same time, the birds also remind him that they are different. And really what he's describing is landscapes in which birds are the inhabitants, in which they are the residents, not humans. He is at the periphery of that. And these birds will tell him that he is.
Well, anybody who's seen a flight of gannets off the coast can really identify and really enjoy his sections of writings about gannets. I mean, I've stood on Cape Ann and watched huge flights of gannets go by and dive. And that's one of the most amazing things to see. When I read Audubon about it, it really captured that kind of emotion that was going on in myself as I was watching them.
Yeah, that's right. That plunge diving of a northern gannet is awe-inspiring.
It's incredible. Now,
and at the same time, just to add this about the gannet essay, so you always have like the personal kind of reference as well. If you see the plate where he's featuring a male gannet and an adult and a young gannet,
right?
And you remember that at the time he was traveling with his son John Woodhouse, whom he was grooming to be his successor, was a 19-20-year-old guy. You know, there's a personal dimension to that as well.
Well, I want to also, before we're going to run out of time, I want to mention that the central sections are sort of bookended by two journals that I'm sure most people have never read. And let's talk about part one is the Journal Aboard the Delos. And it's the original manuscript of this is at the Field Museum of Chicago. What was he doing on the ship?
He was traveling transatlantically to England for this very simple reason that he'd been trying to get his work placed, these gigantic plates that he had in mind. He had these enormous watercolors, and there was no infrastructure to do that work in the United States. He was also being rejected by the emerging ornithological establishment, the Academy of Sciences in Philadelphia, its arch enemy George Ford, was essentially rejecting any effort for Audubon to get traction with printers over there. So he's traveling to England in order to seek his luck there. And he ended up first in Edinburgh, where he did find a printer who worked with him on the first 10 plates. And then he transitioned the entire operation to London, where he worked with Robert Havell, who was really the greatest printer at the time, able to do this kind of work. But we selected portions from the journal, which is much, much longer, in which he focuses on what he sees, the bird life and the marine life that he observes as he's traveling in 1826.
And there's also these drawings that he's making of, like, sailors aboard the ship.
Yes, they're fascinating. They're fish.
I never knew that he made made those kinds of drawings before. So he's not only observing the world, the natural world, the bird life around him, and the fish, he's observing life aboard ship.
Yes, and he had some previous training as an artist, training on the job. Really, he was for a time. He survived as a painter of deathbed portraits. So he could hire Audubon when he was still struggling to make a living as an artist. You could hire him, and he would paint your deceased relatives, and he would end up with a charcoal sketch. So he had done images of people before.
Now, the one thing about this section that's a little bit funky is that you've maintained his original spelling and punctuation.
Yes, Rich and I went back and forth about that. And
I think it's fascinating. It's I got a feel. It gave me the feeling that I was reading an actual journal that way. You know, it's probably how he's writing aboard. But man, he really varied his spelling and punctuation and capitalizations wildly.
One has to remember too that when you read his bird essays, these are cleaned up versions of Audubon's original writing. He had a collaborator, Scottish ornithologist William McGillivray, who would edit what Audubon had written. But in the journals, and that's the fascinating part of it, you get Audubon raw. Yeah, you get this man who never completely mastered English grammar entirely and didn't care because his version of English was so much more expressive than anything that he could have been taught by anybody. So the language kind of, in a way, adjusts itself to Audubon's wild energy and reflects it, which is why we wanted to preserve the original spelling.
Now, the other end of the book is sections from his expedition up to Labrador in 1833, and most of that is lost, right?
Yes, we do have a sanitized version of the Labrador Journal that was edited by his granddaughter, Maria, who destroyed a lot of the original journals and revised them or presented them in her own version. So we do not have the original of that. However, we have something pretty close to it. Audubon's widow, Lucy, after he died, set herself the task to write his biography, and she compiled a manuscript that she sent to an editor in England, Buchanan, who then worked on it and tried to get it into a form that would be more presentable to the public. However, she never got her manuscript back from him. So we think that this version is actually closer to the original diary, which we don't have anymore. So we use that in order to reprint the journal in our edition.
There's an interesting tone to that journal. He's old. He's older now. He's working in the cold. And although he appreciates the wildness of the landscape, the cold really bothers him in that section of the book.
Yes, it does. And he's in the ship. He's painting on board, and there's like moisture dripping down and things like that. So Labrador is not, the way he experiences, is not a very hospitable world for him. Again, it's a world where the birds are at home, which is why he wanted to go there. That's where bird life originates. That's where birds are being born. And that was so fascinating to him. But there's no denying the fact that this kind of this work frightens him a little bit.
Yep.
He also sees how birds are diminishing. The Eskimo curlew, for instance, is the only bird represented in Audubon's work that's actually represented as dead. The mate is looking at it, and you see the female sort of lying down and fading in color, really. And you get dead birds as prey, but you don't get a bird that's just plain dead. And that's what he paints when he's in Labrador.
Richard, talk to me about his description of the great auk, which he never saw a live great auk, right?
Yeah, that's right. He, you know, there are a couple birds in the Birds of America that he painted from really just only specimens. And Christoph has a great description in the beginning of the anthology of the Great Auk and, you know, how he has to sort of formulate it from his brother-in-law who sees one on his own transatlantic.
Wow. And he, so, and his, and he also, he never made it to the Pacific, yet he has the black-footed albatross in there too.
Yeah, the Pacific specimens are really complicated. They're really difficult for us to sort of develop those notes because most of them are really just taxidermied skins that have been sent over by various other explorers or naturalists. And so sometimes Audubon is really just working from other texts and trying to determine those species, and we're trying to match them to current species today. And some of those specimens almost certainly actually did not come from the west coast of the United States.
Whoops.
It might have been collected farther to the south. So it's a little bit of a mystery, some of these paintings.
How hard was it to sort out the current names versus the names he used?
Oh, it was really a challenge for us. and, you know, we had a lot. Hugh Powell from the Cornell Ornithological Lab helped us a lot with putting some of these together. And as you know, bird taxonomy is continually in flux and evolving. And so we just did our best.
Bird taxonomy is a mess. Every year it's a different list. But you mentioned, Christoph mentioned that Eskimo curlew that he shot in Labrador and showed it dead. And what is that, Richard, what does that mean to you emotionally? It as Christoph was talking about, to me it had a lot of emotional impact, especially now that the Eskimo curlew is extinct.
Yeah. Audubon, you know, he paints the Great Auk. He has this great description in his biography, which we don't include in our anthology, about the passenger pigeon and the Eskimo curlew. And so it is a really interesting, this whole thinking about Audubon writing in the 1820s and 1830s and how sort of completely unaware he has become synonymous with conservation organizations in the 20th and 21st century and how he was sort of grappling with it. And thinking about loss, and you know, he was aware of extinction and habitat loss all along the U.S. East Coast.
Yep.
Later in that journal, he talks about imagining seeing Sir Walter Scott in his own journal, and just how much he says, "Scott, you've got to get over here because we're cutting down the forest and we're messing up the rivers. You got to get over here now and describe this amazing country before it is depleted, you know, because of the hand of man." So he recognizes that, but at the same time, you know, as we've discussed, his conservation is very much about collection and a work of art rather than actually trying to work to reduce human impact.
One of the other interesting things that comes out in this book is race and racism in Audubon and his attitudes towards... First of all, he grew up in Haiti. He was born in Haiti, and then he grew up in Louisiana. His attitudes that come out in the journals towards Black Americans and Native Americans is really sort of a problematic. Can somebody?
It absolutely is.
And I want to say for the benefit of the audience, you talk about this at length in the book.
Yeah. And it's something that Audubon biographers, Audubon scholars have been aware of. It's only in the last few years that it's sort of risen to a level of attention that has led to discussions about the name change, possible name change of the Audubon Society. And
right.
So forth. He was the son of a merchant who owned a plantation in Haiti. And traded human beings. And so his father, and we do actually have bills from sales of enslaved people that carry his father's name. So it was, I won't say in his DNA, but it was certainly something that he knew about from the beginning of his life. And he owned enslaved people when he was in Henderson, Kentucky, and sold them. And one of the things that is worth remembering, if you look at his splendid achievement, if you look at these gorgeous plates and the 3,000 pages of text and so forth, Ottman was able to do that because other people did the work that he had to do. And he had a store in Henderson, Kentucky, which was run by enslaved people. So he worked in the general context of slavery. He was not particularly aware of what he was doing. We have no political comments from him that reflect any kind of insight into that. Black people served as guides and as wilderness guides. They had information for him. They are referred to in his writing as being knowledgeable about certain things. So they would hunt for him, with him. That's something worth remembering as well. Yet they are not mentioned by name in his writing. So that's sort of the general context. As far as indigenous people are concerned, there are some pretty upsetting remarks in the journal. Absolutely. He had no elevated kind of consciousness of their situation. Effects that conquests had had on their lives, and it's something that we have to keep in mind when we write about Audubon. He was a complex person, contradictory, and cannot be sort of easily kind of fit into any kind of model of what a human being should be like. You'll never be the St. Francis of the bird world. You've already pointed that out. But at the same time, he's not somebody that we should ascribe to any kind of knowledge or wisdom that transcended birds, which is what he was mostly interested in.
There's a line at the end of the book, you write, he was a man of his time, but not ahead of his time. And yes. that I think, wonderfully sums it up. My guests tonight have been Christoph Irmscher. He is the he directs the Wells Scholars Program at Indiana University Bloomington, where he's also Distinguished Professor of English. And Richard J. King, visiting Associate Professor of Maritime Literature and History at the Sea Education Association in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. And we've been talking about the book that they edited and commented on, Audubon at Sea, The Coastal and Transatlantic Adventures of John James Audubon. Christoph and Richard, it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's been fun.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.